Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. The Olympics are just around the corner, and there's a lot being said in the media, both negative and positive. So For Host First Nations Director Tawani Joseph will give us an overview of what's happening right now from last-minute details, and he also explains what he thinks about the authentic Aboriginal-stamped souvenirs made in China. And the First Nations Bank of Canada has had a record year, with loans up 20% and assets up 5%. And the bank is about to open a new branch, so First Nations Bank CEO Keith Martell will talk about that. Plus, how the Indian Act and First Nations Lands Management Act policies have an effect on borrowing. And the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business is calling for participants in its second mentoring program. And an Arizona state senator has proposed a ban called Don't Pay to Pray. Senator Albert Hale will tell us about it. And that came after three people died during a sweat lodge ceremony performed by New Age guru James Arthur Ray. And Avatar has been out more than a month, and we'll speak with Indigenous fantasy author Daniel Heath Justice about whether the movie is just eye candy or is there something deeper there. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. U.S. President Barack Obama is being pressed to offer an out-loud apology to the Native American community. An apology resolution was signed by the president before Christmas to no fanfare and no media attention. Now, top legislator Senator Sam Brownback wants the president to utter the apology out loud, just like Canada and Australia have in 2008. Brownback told Indian Country Today that political games shouldn't be played with something as important as a Native American apology, but he senses the White House may be facing pressure as it does not want to appear weak or overly politically correct. Brownback has been pushing for the apology since 2004. Meanwhile, executive director of the Indian Law Resource Center told the newspaper, "What kind of apology is it when they don't tell the people they're apologizing to?" Dayto First Nations in the Northwest Territories are fighting a caribou hunting ban. Northern News Service reports the ban came into effect January 1st this year and created a no-hunting zone the size of New Brunswick. The herd has been dwindling in numbers. It has gone from 130,000 strong in 2003 and down to about 32,000 in 2009. Dayto leaders held a meeting in late January where they unanimously passed a resolution stating the ban should not apply to the Akecho First Nation members. Leaders are concerned the ban interferes with their treaty rights and interferes with Section 35 of the Constitution. Dayto Grand Chief Samuel Gargan says he will not back down on his treaty, but adds although treaty rights have to be honored, Dene laws with respect to animal conservation also have to be followed. The Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business has announced its Aboriginal Business Mentorship Program. The CCAB is looking for participants as both mentors and entrepreneurs to partner up the two to help guide and support entrepreneurs with business goals. Joseph Bastine is the Mentorship Program Coordinator with the CCAB. He says it's easy for an entrepreneur to start a business, but not necessarily grow the business, and that's where the program will help.
Once you've got your business off the ground and once you start to become profitable and you have opportunities to grow, there really isn't anybody out there in Canada, at least for Aboriginal entrepreneurs, to come alongside and to encourage, equip, and just assist as they need to grow in the marketplace, to develop new products, to develop new marketing strategies, to expand their distribution, whatever it is the Aboriginal entrepreneur wants to do to grow their business.
This is the second year of the program, which started in Ontario and has now expanded to include five provinces in the country. Applications to participate in the program can be obtained through the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business's website at ccab.com. A recently published report by the David Suzuki Foundation indicates Aboriginal knowledge about the boreal forest can offer scientists important information. The report states Aboriginal knowledge is more important than ever, with the boreal forest facing increasing threats from climate change, habitat loss, and invasive species. The report also describes the botanical and ecological knowledge of Aboriginal people gained over thousands of years of using the boreal forest as a grocery store, pharmacy, school, and spiritual center. And according to scientist and environmentalist environmentalist David Suzuki, harvesting, processing, and selling wild plants such as blueberries from the boreal forest offer sustenance and profit to many northern communities in the country. Suzuki adds, industrial activities undertaken without the prior involvement or consent of indigenous people can harm important species that sustain community health and well-being. The report also suggests much more indigenous mapping of the boreal forest has taken place than previously understood. For example, scientific information is encoded in indigenous language and passed on through stories and place names. There's continuing controversy surrounding authentic Aboriginal art, which has artists concerned that the souvenirs have stamps that are made in China. But Tawani Joseph, a director of Four Host First Nations, told the American Free Press that it's okay because the design was created by authentic First Nations and the Four Host Nations created the whole Aboriginal mark of the games and we are truly authentic Aboriginal people. Meanwhile, a distributor of West Coast Aboriginal art disagrees and has launched an online petition to denounce the foreign-made souvenirs with authentic Aboriginal stamps. Shane Jackson says one of the differences, besides authenticity, is benefits from the local art goes back to the communities to help youth. Meantime, staying with the Olympics, a group of BC First Nation leaders is promising to carry out a campaign to foreign media during the Olympics. They want to mount pressure on Canada to get the government to sign the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. While Chief Wayne Christian, spokesman for the Shuswap Tribal Council, applauds the Four Host First Nation involvement with the Winter Games, he says it's a great starting point, but adds there's much more work to be done after the Games to address issues such as Aboriginal human rights, missing and murdered women, poverty, and rights and title. The Canadian Press reports the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed 3 years ago by a 143-4 margin. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the U.S. did not endorse the declaration, but Australia has since signed on and New Zealand is reconsidering its position. The Canadian government apparently has concerns with wording in the document. The Saskatchewan government says it has lost confidence in the First Nation University of Canada and has cut its funding. Education Minister Ed Norris announced earlier this week that the province will not be providing its $5.2 million in funding starting this spring. Norris says the clout around FNUC is starting to tarnish post-secondary education in the province. Controversy has been surrounding the university for about 5 years now, with ongoing issues of management as well as recent allegations of financial irregularities. First Nation leaders in New Brunswick are considering legal action against the province for not consulting the communities on the proposed NB power deal with Quebec. The leaders met in Fredericton earlier this week. Tubbock First Nation Chief Stuart Paul told the CBC the provincial government signed an agreement 3 years ago that First Nations would be involved in decisions on issues that involve them. Paul says that hasn't been the case with NB Power, even though First Nation resources would be included in the deal. He says if the province doesn't involve the affected communities, New Brunswick could find itself in court. And the First Nation leaders are not only concerned about the NB Power deal, but also a provincial government proposal call for more than 30 licenses to search for oil and gas. And Papineau First Nation Chief Peter Paul says the land included in the call areas are traditional Aboriginal territories. Garden River First Nation in Ontario is proposing a toll booth on the highway through its reserve. Lyle Sayers, chief of Garden River, told the Sioux Star the community is seriously considering the toll on a portion of Highway 17 to make up for an annual funding shortfall of about $1 million. And the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs told the paper it will be starting a dialogue soon with the First Nation. Meanwhile, the Ontario government won't say if it believes its right-of-way agreement with Garden River should preclude the community from charging a toll to travelers. The paper also reports a decade-old deal saw the province hand over cash, land, and a portion of the construction project to the Anishinaabeg Band that paved the way for the new four-lane highway's completion, but Chief Sayer says nothing in writing prevents it from imposing the toll. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
So long you've forgotten.
was Najuan with Ambe from his CD Begin. Najuan is also in the opening lineup for the Olympics venue performance with the likes of Buffy St. Marie in the nightly performances at the Aboriginal Pavilion. The 2010 Winter Olympics are almost here, and the games start next weekend, and the four host First Nations have been very busy with all of their preparations. And Chief Executive Officer of Four Host First Nations, Tawani Joseph, gives us an overview of the last-minute details of what's going towards helping host the games in Vancouver.
We're being prepared for our pavilion to be opened on the 12th of February, where there will be First Nations, Inuit, and Métis from right across the country, from every region in Canada represented. So we're getting ready for that, as well as we'll be featuring cuisine there, an Aboriginal cuisine menu, as well as we're getting ready for our artisan village, where we'll have approximately 100 artisans from across the country as well, with some of their handcrafted products and others, and getting ready for a fashion show as well. And then also we're doing business matching, so Aboriginal businesses will be coming into Vancouver and looking at connecting businesses from around the world with our Aboriginal people here. So all the preparation is just in its final stages, but we're very excited about the opportunity coming.
That sounds pretty awesome. And I bet you have to take the good with the bad, because there's been many positives and negatives as well. For instance, lots of talent to be seen, and some of these nations are speaking out using the Olympic venue to air issues and are still saying positive things. And also the impact the Russian skaters had with their Aboriginal style routine that we found out. What are you thinking about the coverage that this has received so far?
Well, I think it's been very good. I think we've always maintained that we have many challenges that face Aboriginal people in this country, from poverty to suicide, but also even the missing women that I think needs more attention. So I think when people look at what we're doing, although we're focusing in on celebrating our culture, because oftentimes we don't celebrate our cultures enough, I believe, we also have many issues that we're facing right now. We need more schools, and there's lack of education. So I think the attention that we're getting from around the world is very positive for all Aboriginal people, because we have a long way to go. And I think the Olympics is not really the end, but the beginning of the new relationships and partnerships that need to be created to address our challenges. So I think, you know, there are many positive things, but also there are many meaningful things that need to be talked about.
Okay, and you're just coming out with a welcome video. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The welcome video, we wanted to make sure that people get a sense of what we've been trying to do in the games, and also focus in on, I believe, you know, many positive things that happen in our community, because oftentimes in the media, people view Aboriginal people as always in crisis, always, you know, in negative situations. And I always believe that, you know, if you see enough of those images all the time, you think things are impossible. So we wanted to focus in on things that are possible, and actually on the world stage in the Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games, you know, we should be partners all the time. I think it's going to make for better experiences for everybody, including our own Aboriginal people, but also I think for all of Canada can benefit from our expertise. I think we're sophisticated business people, as well as, you know, performing artists are second to none that we have in this country.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what we'll be seeing in that welcome video exactly.
In the welcome video, you will see a combination of a contemporary song blended with one of our traditional songs, as well as Corrine Hunt. She designed the medals for the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games, as well as you will see some of the footage from the torch relay that has happened across the country with the North, as well as some of our traditional footage of canoe pullers and also contemporary performers as well. So you get a sense of all those types of things that have happened in the games in terms of a 3-minute short inspirational video.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to say or add, Joseph?
All I would like to say is that, you know, I've been lucky enough to travel across this country, you know, probably sometimes, I think, 2 times across this country, to personally send an invitation to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people, and there will be in every region everybody coming. But I think, you know, we call it the world's biggest potlatch, because it's not what you take, it's what you give to people, and we're going to share our cultures, all of our cultures, with the world.
That was Tawani Joseph, Chief Executive Officer of the Four Host First Nations for the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. The First Nations Bank of Canada has had a record-breaking year with loans and assets on the rise, and the bank will be seeing more growth ahead. Here's First Nations Bank of Canada CEO Keith Martel.
Well, we had a number of strategic and financial goals we set for the bank for fiscal 2009, and I think for the most of them, the biggest strategic goal was accomplishing the transition of full control of the bank to our Aboriginal shareholders. We raised new capital in 2007, which brought our Aboriginal shareholders up to 80% control of the bank. And the agreement we had when we founded the bank had some period whereby we had to operate the bank in good fashion, and then transition control and finish our relationship that we started with TD Bank when we formed the bank. So that came to pass in 2009, and as we sit today, the bank is fully under the control of our shareholders, 80.1% of whom are Aboriginal groups from across Canada. So that was a large strategic goal, and we're very proud of that. On the financial side, I have a time growing our bank, so we have future opportunities to continue to grow it even larger. And we had targets to meet in just the return and the growth of our loans and our deposits, and we met those targets for this year. So all in all, if you sum those strategic goals and financial goals up, it was for us.
Okay, and I'm looking at deposits. Like, how many people have access to the First Nations Bank?
Well, we primarily have deposits around the branches we have. We have six branches today, opening a seventh branch in Iqaluit, Nunavut in April. I think today, if I look at all our customers, we have about 10,000 accounts. You know, we're not just restricted to Aboriginal people banking with us, First Nations people. We're a chartered bank under the Bank Act of Canada. Anybody can deal with us. And we still use the TD platform to operate our bank on. So we have the opportunity to have customers in locations where we don't have a branch. But primarily our customers, our deposit customers, our personal customers are centered around the branches we do have in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Northern Quebec, Southern Ontario, Whitehorse, and soon to be Iqaluit. So.
Okay, and I see that business of loans is going well.
It's been a really good year. We expand our business a lot in the regions where we have shareholders. So if you look at the shareholders that we have a big concentration of shareholders in Saskatchewan. The Saskatchewan Indian Equity Foundation, which is owned by all the First Nations of Saskatchewan, was our founding shareholder and the company that really was behind our formation. And so you look at the First Nations in Saskatchewan, the real affinity to dealing with the bank that they own and that really represents and focuses on their interests and their realities. So it's not that we have a lower standard of credit. I think it's just we understand the environment better and we can be very competitive. We also don't lose a lot of money on our loans, which is important for a bank. You don't want to be losing a lot of money. You know, where we have shareholders like in Saskatchewan and large concentration of shareholders in Yukon also. Our growth's very good there. Same in Quebec, Manitoba, and other markets. And with the Iqaluit branch coming on, that was a new shareholder that came on in 2007. It's our first Inuit shareholder. And so it proves that the environment that we focus on is not just a First Nations environment. It's about Aboriginal people. It's about their hopes and wants and needs and how their governments exist, socioeconomic conditions they operate in, how they own assets, those kind of things is what we really focus on and what we understand.
So are there ways that, since it is the First Nations Bank, that you can work your way around different policies regarding on-reserve businesses and that sort of thing? Because a lot of banks require so many other things that First Nations people on reserve really can't hand over because they don't really have it, because it's more like a communal land-based concept.
Right. Yeah, you're speaking of 1989, the Indian Act, which is often cited as a restriction from lending institutions is why they, you know, aren't able, or it's more difficult and more expensive to do business on reserve. And Section 89 does restrict access to assets on reserve, and it's an impediment in some lending circumstances where there's a high concentration of collateral for a loan. So the equipment or that a business might own where it's residing on reserve. Technically, Section 89 of the Indian Act restricts a bank from taking security on that. You know, we focus that in a number of different ways. Really, what banks are really most interested in is having a viable business that continues to pay its loans and the cash flow that's created from it. And for the most part, that's, you know, much more important than collateral at the end of the day, because it keeps the loan going. With communities to make sure that they have access to credit, and sometimes that requires them to consider foregoing the protection that might be afforded under Section 89 of the Indian Act, and we work with some communities to do that. In many circumstances, we look to other sources of security, and we're also involved in a pilot loan program that provided some security for banks, not complete security, but some assurance that there was some loan loss provisions for on-reserve lending. Now, that program has limited applicability, but it helps a little bit, and it adds to the things we already do on reserve. So I don't think it's a matter of changing the rules, having different rules. It's just a matter of understanding the environment better and finding ways to do good business with those restrictions in place.
Now with more First Nations getting on board with the First Nations Lands Management Act, does that have a more positive impact on lending?
it's going to create a more normalized environment. You know, it's going to allow banks like ours and others to look at it in a more sort of normal fashion, where you can take security on the land that that people have on Earth. But ultimately, I think that has to be again, it makes it easier. But ultimately, your focus is on working customers, and both commercial and personal, who have the capacity to continue to pay their loans, because taking security means the loan's gone bad, right?
Mm.
And that's not really where we want to be as a bank, and that's not where we want, you know, our shareholders. We don't want people to put their ownership of their land at risk. We want them to keep paying their loans, and they want to keep owning the assets that they borrowed for. So that's ultimately going to make it easier, but you still have to understand the environment and work with people in the socioeconomic conditions they operate in.
That was Keith Martel, CEO of the First Nations Bank of Canada. Coming up, the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business is calling for participants in its second mentoring program. But first, let's hear Help This World by Don Amaro from his CD, Change Your Life. Council for Aboriginal Business is looking for participants for its second Aboriginal Entrepreneur Mentoring Program. Program coordinator Joseph Bastien says the program has grown from being offered only in Ontario to include more provinces now.
The Aboriginal Business Mentorship Program actually really pulls us back to the original roots of CCAB, which was to create an opportunity for corporate Canada to engage Aboriginal business and to give Aboriginal businesses opportunities to grow and expand rapidly. The Aboriginal Business Program itself essentially takes Aboriginal entrepreneurs who've been in business about 3 years or more and pairs them up with a mentor who's an industry expert in their field. And they're really tailored to the needs and the goals of the Aboriginal entrepreneur and how they want to grow and develop their business.
Okay, so you have a new program this year, and you're looking for entrepreneurs and companies to partner them up to do this mentorship program. What kind of businesses are you looking to be involved?
You know, we're really open to any sort of business across any kind of field. It's not so much the nature of the business itself as much as the passion of the entrepreneur to grow their business. We have a fantastic network where we can draw mentors from to meet the needs of any of the entrepreneurs. So really, we feel that we can address the needs of any Aboriginal entrepreneur and find a mentor who will be able to help them to develop their goals.
Okay, and what sorts of industries or fields have been involved in the past?
We've had everything from, we had one entrepreneur last year who ran her own kind of a beautician corporation. We've had consultants. We've had a really, really diverse group. This year's group of applications for protégés are everything from chef to furniture companies, more consultants, some people who are involved in forestry. It's a really, really diverse group.
Usually how many partnerships happens year to year?
Well, last year we were running the pilot project, so we solely ran the program in Ontario. We had five pairs of teams in Ontario. So five mentors and five protégés. This year, we're looking to expand the program nationally. So we're looking to have five different teams based in British Columbia, Alberta, Ontario, and Saskatchewan, paired with five mentors from those provinces as well.
Okay, so about 20 teams nationwide.
Exactly.
How important do you think a program or a mentorship program like this is?
We feel it's very important. In the Aboriginal marketplace right now, there are a lot of government and community dedicated programs to help a company start up. So there are a lot of groups that will help you to write a business plan, that will help you with startup funding. If you want to get your business going, there are a lot of opportunities for you to engage in partners that will get your business off the ground. But we realize that there is a need, because once you've got your business off the ground and once you've started to become profitable and you have opportunities to grow, there really isn't anybody out there in Canada, at least for Aboriginal entrepreneurs, to come alongside and to encourage, equip, and, you know, just assist as they need to grow in the marketplace, to develop new products, to develop new marketing strategies, to expand their distribution, whatever it is the Aboriginal entrepreneur wants to do, you know, to grow their business. We have a lot of stuff for startups, but we don't have a lot of encouraging opportunities for existing businesses in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And to help out with growing pains and so forth.
Exactly. And that's one of the great things we got from our protégés is that, you know, they had a lot of questions. And when you're an entrepreneur and you're really, really busy and you need that objectivity to come into your business and say, well, you know what, you can make adjustments here, or the questions that you have can be really easily answered, mm-hmm. that can help you to push past those speed bumps and really, you know, energize the growth of your business and make it more effective and more efficient.
So have you had any interest so far?
We have. We've had applications from across Canada right now. We've had even some people, you know, asking us to expand the program, which we are looking at doing in the future. But for now, we are right now only accepting applications from British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Ontario. But the response so far has been fantastic, and I'm really encouraged by it. You know, I would just encourage any Aboriginal entrepreneurs who think this might be a great opportunity for them and their business to visit. The application forms are downloadable, and you can just, you know, fire them off to me. There's a link for that on our website.
That was Joseph Bastien, Program Coordinator for the Aboriginal Business Mentoring Program at the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business. Albert Hale is a Democratic senator in Arizona and also the former president of the Navajo Nation. He proposed Senate Bill 1164, which is a ban to not pay to pray. Senator Hale proposed the bill after three people lost their lives last fall while participating in a sweat lodge ceremony performed by New Age guru James Arthur Ray. It's a tricky bill with all kinds of implications in respect to human rights and freedom of religion, but Hale is hoping the bill will prevent such incidents from happening again.
You are aware of three people dying out of an incident that took place back in October last year.
Right, yes.
Over in Sedona, Arizona. Evidently, the guy, James Ray, I think was his name, advertised his retreat, I think it was for 2 weeks and maybe a week, and caused those people to pay about $12,000 a person. And he took them through some retreat that involved sort of starvation, and in the end, there was this what was referred to as sweat lodge ceremony, and evidently he supervised it. There was a structure that was built for that purpose, covered with tarp and plastic, and I don't know exactly how it was heated, probably by hot stones, which is the way Native Americans do their sweat. But in the process of doing that, he put in close to 6 people in that small structure. 2 of them died there as a result of suffocation or whatever, and 1 died at the hospital. Anyway, so that being the situation, I wanted to address mainly health and safety of those people who may not know what an authentic Native American ceremonial practices are. Health, safety, and welfare is of primary importance. And then secondly, to preserve and protect authentic Native American ceremonial practice. So those are the 2 things that I was trying to address. And the way I did it, I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at the bill that I introduced. It's basically just a directive to one of the state agencies, mainly the Department of Health Service, a directive to that agency, and the directive being formulate and adopt rules that will regulate person or any business that charges people to participate. So that's what I'm trying to address. And then there's a subsection or a section B, which says that the rules will not apply to practices that are conducted on tribal land and are authorized by the tribal jurisdiction's governing authority. So basically, I was trying to direct the agency in the formulation of these rules to address those practices off reservation, whether that be by non-Indian or Indian, because we, as you know, state laws don't apply on Indian reservations. So that's what I am trying to do with the bill. Rather than, if you'll notice, rather than the bill trying to say we're going to prohibit this type of practice off reservation lands, it's saying that we will regulate it to protect health, safety, and wealth of individuals who participate. That's basically the direction that I'm intending the rules to go. And I didn't come up with any laws that say you can do this or here's the regulation of that nature, because this requires a longer discussion than the time that the legislators have, because mm-hmm. you would have to have medicine people, healing people from different American tribes within the state don't come in and say some of the things that are being abused out there. And we'd like to have this type of rule to help to regulate and minimize those abuses. And you have 22 different Indian nations within the state of Arizona. Now, obviously, their ceremonial practices are vary and they're different from one to the other. So I didn't want to come up with a law that without consulting the traditional healers.
When you were saying a little bit earlier, Senator, that perhaps that these practices should be just on the reservations and be perhaps allowed by the local tribal government, that's kind of opening another whole can of worms there. And also, a lot of people don't live on their reservations and, in fact, live in urban centers and then, you know, wanting to have a healer over at their place to conduct a ceremony for their family. Like,
I'm aware of that, and those are questions that have been raised before. And the way I responded was that if the tribal jurisdictions come up with their own rules about how one way to regulate internally is to come up with regulations that certify or license traditional healers. And one thing that I am looking at immediately to amend is paragraph B of this proposed bill, where it says this section does not apply to practices that are conducted on tribal lands. So as long as it's being conducted on tribal land, these rules will not apply. And it says, and that are authorized by tribal jurisdictions governing authority. I would drop the and put or, so that if there's a body on Navajo, for example, and I know there's a body that does this, Navajo Medicine Man Association, and they're developing certification for their medicine man. If they develop those certification and they give it to one of their members and that member comes off to Phoenix they're certified, and that gets away from people who are not learned in the area from performing those ceremonies that they have very little knowledge of. So that's the way I am addressing that.
Hmm.
And you also have to realize that there are some of our own members are abusing this. You know, recently there have been cases in federal courts where medicine men have been charged with
abuses of various types.
Abuse of a person, assault on a person while performing the ceremony. You know, there are people like that within our membership, and obviously that's not a matter that can be addressed through state law because of sovereignty of Indian nations, and they have to address that themselves.
That was Arizona State Senator Albert Hale. Now here's Jenny Lazon with Bigger Than All of Us from her CD, Mixed Blessings. The blockbuster movie Avatar has been in theaters since December and has been drawing all kinds of attention from indigenous communities worldwide. The online magazine Survival International reports the Penan people in Malaysia say the movie is real because of the portrayal of resource extraction from indigenous communities, and in this case, a whole planet. Other pundits think the storyline is predictable and compare it to Pocahontas or Dances with Wolves, myself included, and indigenous author and University of Toronto Indigenous Literature Studies professor Daniel Heath Justice has written a blog about it, and he spoke with Bombsita.
I didn't hate the movie. I thought I would. I thought there were some really strong aspects of it. Unfortunately, I think the negative aspects outweighed the good. I think it's getting people talking about colonialism and exploitation and a disregard for the natural world, which I think, you know, those are good conversations to have, but I think, unfortunately, it's done in a way to pretty much just follow in a very standard line of white messiahs who come into an indigenous community, become more indigenous than they are, and saves them from the colonial forces rather than actually the indigenous people being able to save themselves. And so I think for whatever good it's offered, it's also, again, reinforces the idea of indigenous people not being able to stand up for ourselves, that we don't have the intelligence or capacity to provide solutions of our own. We always have to, apparently, you know, according to Hollywood anyway, we always have to wait for a white messiah to help us along.
Mm-hmm. I know we had a lot of dialogue coming home from Avatar since I live an hour away from town. So my partner, he thought overall it was a really good movie, and there was some of the things he mentioned in your blog, he mentioned some of the same things too, with a sort of that Western sort of twist and a few other things. But I expected not to like it either, and I really enjoyed the 3D effects.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of eye candy there going on.
Yeah, visually it was a stunning movie. Mm-hmm. And you have to see it in 3D if you are going to see it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I like one of the other things you say in your blog when you're talking about war, you know, the difficult decisions that some people make. And that was also kind of interesting, too, because one of the things I noticed when the military members were going out was when it panned over those military members, most of them had brown faces.
And yet they don't really do much with that.
Mm-mm.
And even the people of color, they're still treated as cardboard villains, and the main villain is definitely that way. I mean, there's no sense that, you know, people can do really evil, awful things and do it out of duty, not because they're intending to be evil, awful people. And I think that's a nuance that could have really been impressive with this. I mean, what do you do with a complex situation like that? People are doing awful things. He made all of his military folks, except for the one brown woman who ends up dead at the end.
Yeah.
Anytime you see a Latina in science fiction, she's going to die. You know it.
I also noticed that you wrote that it could have been a little more compelling had he explored the culture of the Na'vi.
Yeah.
But in when I was watching it, I kind of liked that he didn't go too much into a lot of things, because there is so much there, but it kept the story going.
Well, I think for me, it would have been interesting actually to have the movie be about the Na'vi instead of about the white man, Jake Sully, who becomes a hero, about his redemption and salvation. Because it's his story. It's not the story of the Na'vi. The Na'vi are wallpaper for him and for his journey. That the, you know, the white man comes into the native community and participates in things, but he does it for his transformation as a human being. And ultimately what happens to them is pretty inconsequential. So I would have loved to have seen it just about the Na'vi.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were more interesting. And I thought he was actually the least interesting character. And so that seemed like a very odd choice for your point character.
And the other thing, too, when my partner and I were watching it, and towards the end, you know, when he brings down his flying animal.
Oh, yeah.
And and then she jumps him after he went and tamed that big thing in the sky. My partner says that it would have been it had she stayed on the animal with him, because she was portrayed as such a strong being throughout the movie, and then jumps on the back of the bird thing with him.
Well, and then they make an interesting point that, you know, Jake learns to bond with these flying raptor creatures, but he bonds with a smaller one at first. And Neytiri, his Na'vi partner, says that this creature will only bond to one person, one Na'vi, for the rest of its life. But he abandons that bond for the bigger creature. So the raptors only bond once in a lifetime, but apparently Jake Sully can bond numerous times and there's no consequence and no disregard. So it was really, I thought, wow, okay. He apparently hasn't learned the lessons of the Na'vi.
Yeah, what happens with the other bird? Just
yeah.
Left.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. Apparently, he was more interested. Bigger was better, apparently.
But unlike in this movie, the way it wraps up is the Na'vi line up the military and send them on their merry way. But unfortunately, in most indigenous communities, when it comes to, you know, big mining operations like that, that does not happen at the end of the day.
No, it's that part. Actually, that was an interesting part that, you know, they chose to keep some humans, but they were the ones who made the choice. The humans didn't impose themselves. The humans who stayed were there because the Na'vi welcomed them. And then they got rid of the ones they didn't welcome. which seemed a constructive way of approaching it. That actually, if you're going to be a guest in someone's home, you're actually a guest.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of kind of reflecting anything we know about resource exploitation in indigenous lands, that was where that was one of the places where the fabric of reality was stretched really thinly.
Well, that's Hollywood.
Yeah. But the thing for me is, I mean, if you're going to spend $300 million on a film, this is an opportunity to be more than Hollywood. This is an opportunity to do something really exceptional and to challenge these conventions. I mean, these conventions are there because they work in a lot of ways, but not because they are honest or fully reflect the kind of political values that James Cameron clearly believes in. Why not add a few of those dollars and work on the narrative a bit more? Maybe something that's actually reflective of indigenous peoples and not, yet again, this deep-seated desire for being a white messiah.
Well, Daniel, any last thoughts on the movie Avatar?
I think it's definitely a movie that people should go see and that people should be talking about. But I think it's also fair that we don't just accept passively what Hollywood gives us, but actually agitate for better stories about indigenous issues and be as supportive as we can be of indigenous filmmakers and playwrights and performers and those who are actually creating the stories reflect our experience, whether they're realistic or fantastical, science fiction, mystery, whatever. We're telling those kinds of stories. We're telling the stories that need to be told, but we also need the audience for that.
That was Daniel Heath Justice, Indigenous Literature Study Professor at the University of Toronto. You've been listening to Bombsidaw with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsidaw is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsidaw means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project 1. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsidaw.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsidaw.